It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios. Welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
We're on Radio Row here in Cleveland. And sitting next to me, across from me, this is kind of funny because he's interviewed me. I've known him for a long time, but I have never interviewed him. His name, I'm not sure, will be familiar. Yeah, it will be now to those of you who listen to Sirius Radio. Steve Bannon is the executive chairman of Breitbart News Network. Breitbart News Network, a powerhouse in so many different ways. So, Steve, now the tables are turned. It's my.
I tell you what, this is because I try to keep a low profile. You actually interviewed me at CPAC at your booth. I think it was last year, but hey, I realized it didn't drive ratings.
It didn't drive ratings.
God, Sandy Rios.
It was a non-event. It was just a non-event.
In fact, I'm not sure. It was one of these. I'm not even sure it made the show. You know, I think Sandy
was on the cutting room floor.
I think Sandy listened late and said, "You know, the guy's not much to say."
Yeah, you know the reason you're accusing me because that's probably what you do with mine. See, so I don't know. Steve,
yours always get a lot of comments. What do you mean for the Target thing? You were on fire. You would come on during the Target boycott, and callers, the boards would light up. I mean, but we dined off Sandy Rios for weeks.
Steve, since you and I talked on the air about that, you know that an actual transgender man was caught in a Target. Over the booth, you know, taking pictures of a 17-year-old girl trying on bathing suits. So, I mean, it really is a legitimate concern that AFA and Breitbart, all of us have, parents, anybody, mothers, you know, anybody that has children or mothers or women in their lives, this is a serious issue, and I appreciate you guys coming alongside us to echo the message of AFA to boycott Target.
Well, I think, look, one of the things at Breitbart, we've tried to provide a platform for, you know, a whole eclectic group of people, social conservatives, the Milo libertarians, the national defense guys, the guys that want to take on radical Islam, you know, across the board. We provide a platform, and that's why I think it's a, you know, people talk about unity and coming together. You can't get a broader spectrum. You know, we're a populist nationalist site, but you can't get a broader spectrum of libertarians, social conservatives. I mean, the day on the radio show, we had nonstop Ted Cruz people talking about what they wanted to hear from Ted Cruz tonight. Every, you know, we took, I think it was 15 callers, and every one of them said, "I'm a Cruz bot, I'm hardcore Cruz, but I do want him to endorse Donald Trump tonight to come together." And they've been some of the, you know, the last holdouts. So it's really, it's fascinating. I think it's, and that's what we love. What we love is people that want to get off the sofa and take action.
Yep.
What we love about AFA and you guys are fighters. I mean, we're a platform for fighters, not a platform for passive people, whether it's the Breitbart site or it's our radio show or what we're doing now on television. It's on live streaming. We're there for fighters. Our audience loves fighters, and you know you're the epitome of that. You've been fighting for a long time.
Thank you, Steve. You too. I mean, have you? I mean, when you met Andrew Breitbart, the founder, namesake of Breitbart News, and I need to say that because we assume people know that, but they don't necessarily. Steve, I met Andrew by phone as a guest before he was Andrew, before he was Andrew Breitbart, and he was out in Hollywood. He started Big Hollywood. That's what I first met him. You know all about this. But when did your life intersect, Andrew?
In 2004, I made a film, In the Face of Evil. I made this film around the 2004 election about the Ronald Reagan off of Peter Schweitzer's book, Reagan's War, that really showed about what you have to do about taking on a ideology. This was the Reagan's War against communism that went for, you know, 50 or 60 years. Through Peter Schweitzer did this amazing book looking at Reagan through the eyes of his enemies in the KGB. And it was really his analogy to the war against radical Islam, because this was in 2004. And it won an award the first night it went to the Liberty Film Festival, which used to be in the heart of Hollywood. It was a big film festival. We were opening night film, and some guy comes out of the you know, it got a standing ovation for like 10 minutes. People were just loving this film. And this guy runs out of the audience, this huge bear of a guy, and literally squeezes me. I was about 40 pounds lighter at the time. No, he squeezed me like a rag doll. And like, you know, I was like a grape. And I said, who is this guy? And he was just all over me. We're going to change Hollywood. We're going to do this. We're taking the cultures upriver from pop. The first time I met Andrew Breitbart, in the first 60 seconds I met him, culture is upriver from politics. And he had a vision what we want to do, and that's when we kind of got to know each other. And then later, I got involved with helping him finance the website. When I went down to the basement, he said, "You got to come and see what I got." And I walked into the basement of his house, and his poor wife said, "You got to get these guys out of here. I don't know what they're doing down there." And he had Drudge. He was the editor of Drudge. He had Drudge on one computer. Literally, go down to the basement, and you got Alex Marlowe is now editor-in-chief, was a kid out of Berkeley that never talked and was just on a computer all day long. And he was either loading water guns, changing diapers, or doing it. Larry Soloff, our CEO, was the lawyer. He was over in the corner, you know, protecting Andrew from all the lawsuits that Andrew had coming in over the transom. And he had John Nolte, who was like living someplace else. He showed up like once a week. The guy was the greatest. In fact, wrote the first review of my film, was at another Libertas. And it was a fantastic, you know, it was very bootstrap, you know, operation. Back in those days, by the way, right before we launched the site, in the days after Andrew died, Andrew took a year to finance it and then to build the site. I think our traffic was like, you know, 8 million, 10 million page views a month. I think we were a million and a half. We're almost doing as many page views a day now as we did a month in 2012. Yesterday was the biggest day in the site's history.
Seriously?
Yeah, we went over.
Do you remember the numbers?
We went over 8 million page views yesterday.
You know, I just read a couple of weeks ago there was some measurement that came out and talked about Breitbart was like the number. I can't remember the
number
category.
One. Okay, so on what we did is that we thought conservative media. We built a homepage, but one of the things we thought conservative media was missing was they didn't quite understand the integration of technology and content. And that's why BuzzFeed and Upworthy and Huffington Post are so much bigger and so much more encompassing. They understand the technology of algorithms. So we took a year to rebuild the site. People don't know this. We rebuilt the site, the back end engine, in 2013 because we had a big strategic meeting where we said we're not ready for Facebook or Twitter or a search engine optimization. We built the back end to be more functional. We have under 2 million likes, which is not, 2 million likes is not huge. In the month of May, we're rated number one in the world by the independent services, number one in the world, political site in the world on social media interactions, in front of the Huffington Post and the Guardian, CNN, the BBC, and the New York Times. Number two is Huffington Post by 2 million interactions in a 30-day period. We did 8 million interactions. There's six. Now, the other thing that just shows overall sites for Facebook, not political. So in political, we're number one in the world. Overall sites, all media, all entertainment, we're number 12 in the world. So the scale of it, and here's what it is. It's 24-hour-a-day news and information, very little opinion, and then we also are on Facebook 24/7 to drive it and to drive this platform bigger and bigger and bigger. So it's people like you. But people like you come. What really drives a site is people that are coming for news and information about people that want to fight and take their country back. And we had the Target story, which AFA led. That's traffic.
You guys helped us amplify that.
And traffic goes through the world. That's what we tell everybody. Yep. People come. If you need to take your message to the next level, we're open for business.
Yes, so. I can attest to that on many levels, not just the Target thing, but, Steve, I just want to say that Andrew Breitbart was walking electricity. He touched every person that he met. He was just an incredible, uncommon man who did not live long but had such great impact. So now you've taken this baby over.
Well, it's a team. It's a team. And look, Andrew, we have Milo today that's got a different sort of electricity. Someone like Andrew, as I tell people, because a lot of people on the left and people like that dismiss him as some kind of, you know, racist buffoon, and you see him at Tea Party meetings. He was one of the most sophisticated people in new media. One of the reasons some of the conservative sites are not working, and even some of the liberal sites, is that you see a lot of magazines or newspapers or even that just have a – they are a legacy system like a newspaper or a journal that has a web page. That's not new media. Andrew Breitbart for 15 years was Drudge's right-hand man. He learned new media through the eyes of a master in Matt Drudge. For 5 years – and this is a lesson I tell young people every time I give a talk – for 5 years, Andrew Breitbart never got a paycheck. For 5 years, he worked as Drudge's apprentice without a paycheck. For 10 years, he never came back of the curtain until he wrote that book about Big Hollywood. Andrew Breitbart, the reason he became such a legendary guy on radio and stuff like that, the very first time he did talk radio, he had all his talking points, and it was like some station out in Wyoming, and the host asked him a follow-on question, and Andrew froze. And so Andrew, when I first met Andrew, he was walking back and forth, and the basketball court is right at the basement. I'm sitting in the basement with Alex. I'm looking, and Andrew's going back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And I'm saying, what is this guy, with the phone, I said, what is this guy doing? He was doing blog, he was calling in as a guest to Blog Talk Radio. And I go, what are you wasting your time? He says, reps, I need reps. He became a great radio guest and TV guest because he froze the first time he did it, and he just did 1,000 radio hits to get better. I keep telling people, this was a guy that self-created himself. He was not a guy that was comfortable out in front of the thing, and it's about self-determination, self-creation, and self and individual responsibility, and that's how Andrew Breitbart became Andrew Breitbart.
Steve, you have a master's from Harvard, which means a certain thing to me, like in terms of your training and upbringing. I'm assuming a lot of things. You are now, I know this. I don't know what you feel about every issue. I'm sure we don't agree on every issue, but you are a hardcore conservative. I think that's fair to say. How did that happen for you?
Well, I come from a blue collar. I come from a very blue collar family in Virginia. You know, a lot of people, enlisted people in the military, in the Navy, in the Army, and people, with the phone company, all Democrats until the '60s Vietnam War, and then I was a naval officer for many years, and on a destroyer, a couple of deployments in the Pacific, in the Persian Gulf. Came back Pentagon, and then went to Georgetown and got a master's degree in national security, and decided while I was in the Pentagon I wanted to go to Wall Street. So I went to Harvard Business School, went to Goldman Sachs, had my own firm, started focusing on intellectual property, and then I've always been, when we say conservative, I am a conservative. I consider myself a nationalist and a populist first, and also I think populism, nationalism, and tradition is modern conservatism. So I came at it that way. But my daughter's a West Point grad, and she's with the 101st Airborne,
I didn't know that.
Yeah, my daughter.
That's very cool.
My daughter went to West Point, and in fact, she was named to the All-League Patriot League team, 25-year team. She was a big star at volleyball at West Point, and she's she served and fought in Iraq with the 101st Airborne. She's now with the 1st Armored Combat Team down in.
That's very cool. I did not know.
No, but so we say conservative. I come at this from a practical point of view of kind of what I think works, and let people, just like the radio show and the site. The site, one of the reasons the site's so big is that we're the number 3 site in the world on comments. This month alone, I think we're going to do 9 million comments on the site. Now, the comment section of Breitbart is not for the faint of heart, right? Because, we made a fundamental decision that a lot of conservatives, we saw a couple of years ago, the conservatives were shutting down comment sites. And one of the reasons they're shutting down comment sites is that the commenters are saying nasty stuff about the writers and the guys running companies. And I said, I don't care if they're going to say nasty stuff about it, that's fine. It's free speech. It'll get. So we took all the controls off virtually. Very few controls on Breitbart in the comment section. And it gets a little rough in there, but the comment section has exploded. It's one of the reasons. And on the radio show, we're very audience driven. We had you on that day. Literally, we'll have a guest on. We call it the Socratic method. I'll ask you a bunch of questions. When you get off, we'll just take a wave of callers that want to talk about Target, that want to talk about American Family, that want to talk about Sandy Rios, that want to, jump in, and that's what we're interested in their comments. So we don't do a lot of opinion on the show.
And, of course, the radio is the part, as one of the new things that you have added, and that's Sirius Radio, Breitbart's Sirius Radio.
Well, so, we've turned down, we actually think we're a huge believer in radio, more than television. People come to us, why don't you have TV? And I said, look, radio is theater of the mind.
Yep.
And we can do so much more leveraging. The Sirius XM, we're 7 days a week. It is literally when we finish the show in the morning, there are more people on our homepage that have come there because of radio than like CNBC and Fox Business, I think, have watching the shows that time. And that's all because of radio.
I'd be curious to know what you think about, this whole business of talk. I love talk radio, too. Obviously, I do it, but I love it better than doing television. I always have. But there's this notion that young people, millennials, whoever, you want to call them, don't like radio. Do you think that's shifting? Do you think that's mice?
We don't see that at all. I think the thing that has to be thought through, I think the paradigm is something we do, this is the way we do differently. We try to rethink the paradigm. I think radio is a huge medium for people. I think what we try to do differently is, like on the website, we have very few columnists. We put up Ann Coulter's column, we put up Charlie Hurt's column with Drudge. But, you know, what we do, and we see people attracted, you give them news, we try to show people and try to tell them. We put up constant news all day long. Like today is the Fox situation, right? We're putting up stories all day long. We let the comments, like in radio, I will have Sandy Rios on. I will ask Sandy Rios 10 questions while I've got her on for 10 minutes or whatever, and then we'll go right to callers. We don't really put our opinions out there. It's the Socratic method. So I think the thing that we feel works is young people are attracted to it, and a newer demographic is attracted to it, but they want to participate. So it's participatory. I don't call it talk radio. We call it news or information, almost listen radio. I think the one paradigm that's shifting is it's just our belief that the model that has existed and been incredibly successful over the last 20, 25 years, where you have a host that just sits there and gives his opinion or talks for 3 hours or 2 hours, that, except for isolated cases, is not going to be broad-based. We believe, and that's why our new service, of a totally different way to rethink that, which is let the audience be the opinion maker. I mean, our thing at Breitbart, we say, we provide the news, you provide the commentary. So it's the Socratic method. And I think radio is at the very beginning of exploding. And I think radio, look, we turn down TV all the time. People go, why don't you do TV? I said, it's a totally different, radio is theater of the mind, and it's more of a hot medium that I think integrates very well. People forget, Matt Drudge had a radio show when he first started the Drudge. You know, he had a radio show on Sunday nights. And it was where we first started. I first started radio on Sunday nights because that drives a news cycle for Monday. Matt Drudge came out of radio. Andrew Breitbart did a ton of radio. Radio has been obviously intricate with Mark Levin and Michael Savage and Rush Limbaugh has been integral to the conservative thought. We think radio is at the top of the first thing, more than television. And by the way, we're trying to think through, we think television has to be done also different. I don't think the model that Fox and CNN, these guys have today, and you can tell by the demographics. It's the reason people say, why don't you have been radio? I said, look, I think I'm one of the smarter guys around in media, and I have no earthly idea how to do TV today to make it profitable, to actually make it something that draws an audience and because I think people are coming to media in a more sophisticated way in new media, and so we haven't thought it through at Breitbart. We're trying to, and it's the big transition online in the next couple of years is going to be, even if you go to Breitbart today, still 80% of our content is written word. I mean, it is a different way we present it, and you know, maybe catchier, maybe gravier, but you are reading. That we know, and again, the guy Jim Vanderhey over at Politico, who's a brilliant guy. You may not like his politics. When he left Politico, he wrote that only a handful of companies are going to do the transition online the next couple of years to go to a more video-based, delivery methodology. That video delivery is quite hard. I mean, we're here at the convention. We are live streaming for 15 hours a day, from 9 in the morning until midnight. After radio's over, we're live streaming television, right? And we're out in the field. We're at Milo's party last night. We're doing the protests. We're cutting back and forth. We're trying to learn, and we're trying to learn how new, see what works, what doesn't work. But this video concept, this video part is enormously complex. And what they're saying is that only a handful of companies are going to make that transition. But those companies that do make that transition successfully as new media companies are going to be dominant companies like Time Magazine and these after World War II. And so our entire focus at Breitbart right now, behind the scenes, which you don't see, is a whole team of people that are trying to think through this video component tied with algorithm, search engine optimization, how we broaden it. And so we'll be rolling out video content in the next month about how to do it. But that's the next big dividing line is going to be that in media.
Steve Bannon, always a pleasure. And now let's just get practical before I say goodbye to you. So it's Breitbart.com, and you still have big business,
We have 12 verticals. We have big government. We have tech, which Milo runs. We have regional. We have London. We have Jerusalem. We have a 12-person bureau in London. We have a 10-person bureau in Jerusalem. Massive traffic out of both. We have a Rome operation. We have Breitbart, California, Breitbart, Texas, and then we have our specific verticals, whether it's sports, big Hollywood for culture, tech with Milo and the crew. He has a 10-man crew, almost all in London, which is not even the London crew. So I think we have like 20 people in London that are either tech-related. When I say tech, new media tech, et cetera. So it's and we intend, we'll double the size of the company by next year. So we're aggressively looking to hire and recruit and we're interviewing people all the time and see if they fit in. So it's something that we're just keeping our heads down and plowing away.
And on Sirius Radio.
Sirius Radio, 7 days a week, 6 to 9. We're morning drive, 6 to 9. And then 10 to a.m. to 1, which is drive time for Saturdays. And then Sunday night, 7 to 10. So we're 7 days a week. And 21 hours of live news radio every week. So
well, that's the reason. Matt Bright, now you know why Breitbart is such a powerhouse. The founder, Andrew Breitbart, was a powerhouse. And
amazing
he
guy.
He really did. The thing I hear about from all of you guys who knew, again, you knew him. I knew him professionally, occasionally. He was always wonderful, warm, humble, just, again, electricity. But you knew him well. And you guys all speak so highly of him, and I know he had tremendous influence on each of your lives.
Oh, he's a genius. I call him Falstaff meets Marshall McLuhan. He was a man's man,
yeah.
Right? He was a man's man, a warrior, but kind-hearted, but a tough guy. But new media, like learning from Drudge, he knew new media, a level of sophistication, shocking. As we tell everybody today, the plan that we're rolling out is really Andrew's plan he came up with 6 or 7 years ago. This plan of these types of verticals, of this type of geographic expansion, this type of regional expansion, the type of coverage we do, the little opinion, and put more news 24/7 a day. Our biggest days for years after we launched the new site, right after, a couple days after Andrew died, which he worked on for a year, was Saturdays, because most people, knock off on Friday afternoons in media, the Friday night dumps of the Obama administration. Saturday would be massive day, because people still want news, and so 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Steve Bannon, again, executive chairman of Breitbart News Network. Steve, thank you for your valuable time. It's great to talk to you.
Sandy Rios,
I didn't get to
much.
Put you on the spot enough, though. I need to think this through.
I'm going to ask you
embarrassing questions or something.
You can ask me as many embarrassing next time, after I have you back on the show. Thanks,
all right. All right, Steve Bannon. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Sandy Rios with you, coming to you live from the Quicken Loan Center here in Cleveland. This is the Republican National Convention, and you never know who you're going to run into walking up and down the corridors, but this next person I've never met before in person, ever. I feel like I know him because I've watched him for years, and honestly, I love what he says now. Lou Dobbs, Lou, you're the gold standard when it comes to discussions of money, but you've really branched out. You talk about, you used to just talk about money, but you talk about so much more now.
Yeah, we started focusing on the political economy because you can't separate politics and money.
No, you can't.
Quite a few years ago, and never has it been better to do that than right now, because the economy, our political system, the global system itself challenged, and we're going to see a lot of change over the course of the next 5 years.
Lou, I'm just curious, did you get your knowledge about finances from being a business person, or did you study it, or both?
I studied economics at Harvard University. I worked for several years in banking, putting together cash management systems for corporations, and learning a lot about both banking and business, big business, covering the city council and doing budgets.
In
Yuma, Arizona, where I first started. Father Monsignor Richard O'Keefe was my early mentor in budgets and nasty politics.
All right, so when you studied economics at Harvard, correct me if I'm wrong. Would it be true to say that Harvard now teaches Marxist economics predominantly? Or are there still some free market capitalists there?
I would assume there are a few that are still bitter clingers that are hanging on, but they may not be as tenured as often as those who have a far more neoliberal view, both economically and politically. That's been the nature of Harvard for a very long time. It's an international institution. And tends to move in that direction.
So when you were young and you studied at Harvard, would you say that when you got into the business world, you moved to the right, or what? What happened to your economic philosophy?
My sophomore year at MIT, I was watching two great economists debating. One of them was Milton Friedman, and the other was Paul Samuelson. And Milton Friedman wiped the stage in front of a bunch of impressionable Harvard and MIT students. And after that, I was a devoted Milton Friedman follower.
He's from my hometown, Chicago, Milton right. Friedman, yeah.
Yeah, so is Barack Obama.
Now, wait a minute. You would have to throw that in. Wouldn't you like to hear them debate?
It wouldn't be very interesting. Milton Friedman would do far wipe the stage with him.
I just want to do a quick hit on a few things here, because, Lou, there's so much speculation about the economy. I met a man in upstate New York just a few days ago who's selling everything. He's buying he wants everything liquid. He's buying a lot of gold. He's actually building a compound somewhere. He's not a crazy man. He's a very successful businessman. I don't know how wealthy, but probably a multimillionaire. Mm-hmm. And he just is serious about, he sees the dollar. He says he's getting out of dollars. I mean, pretty drastic stuff. I mean, how far do you go when you talk about your predictions for this economy? How far do you go to the edge of saying things like that?
Well, I go only to, comfortably to the borders of what I do know. And I think anything else is probably a disservice on the part of those who start making mad, crazy projections like 35,000 on the Dow or 6,000 on the Dow, saying liquidate everything, buy gold or silver. We've seen a run-up, and that's healthy. It's been a bounce back. But the reality is this is about restoring this country to prosperity. And I haven't got much use for folks who are fatalists and who are, frankly, defeatists. I truly believe it when I say I support Donald Trump because he intends to make America great again. We've got a lot to recover from. These last 7.5 years under Barack Obama, historians will be studying what happened and why to this country and why he chose to make the policy decisions he did. But the truth is, millions of Americans are paying a huge price because he simply abandoned American values. Abandon the very idea that this nation's values stand for the world's beacon. And what he has done is try to disrupt and to destroy so much
very successfully. You know, I find it really ironic. And nobody seems to ever, I'm sure you do, I just haven't caught you saying this, but when Hillary Clinton said that she was going to put Bill Clinton in charge of the economy, I'm sorry, I just can't help but think, you know, when they went into the White House, they didn't have anything. Do you remember they'd never owned a home? They had no money. Mm-hmm. And they complained about it, actually. So now they're out of the White House. They've been out, however many years that's been. And they have, you know, millions of dollars in their Clinton Foundation. But before that, they on their own, did not seem to know, except that Hillary Clinton made some windfall.
She made $100,000
in a month or something,
right? $1,000 investment in cattle futures, which is pretty good for any beginner.
Yeah, I'd say.
No, they had a passing acquaintanceship with how to make money. They learned it in Little Rock, Arkansas. When I heard her say that she was going to put the economy put Bill Clinton in charge of the economy, I thought, what a clever campaign move. Here she's running as a strong, independent woman, and the first thing she does is hand over the economy to her husband to take care of. She turns everywhere to Bernie Sanders for support. I mean, it's laughable. And you ask one person, what is her achievement, her crowning achievement? There isn't one in her entire political life. This has nothing to do with politics or ideology. The woman has never accomplished a single thing in her political life.
Back to Trump. You've endorsed Trump. Or you certainly speak in favor.
I'm voting for Trump. Well, I think he's the greatest choice possible.
But you know that a lot of people in your position and traveling in the circles in which you travel, Lou, that's icky to them. It's embarrassing to support Donald Trump. It's like not very popular. So how do you, how do you justify your position?
I don't have to justify it. You know, I've been right on politics and economics for a very long time. My record speaks for itself. And my support for what he is saying is absolute. He is talking about making jobs appear once again in this economy, creating jobs. He's talking about returning investment to this country. We've got over $2 trillion. Corporations who are supposedly working for the United States citizen are leaving their money parked in overseas accounts when that money could be invested in the United States, driving job growth, plant and factory creation, which creates further jobs. This is one of the most ignominious eras in the history of American business, and it's got to be fixed. And Trump is the only one who who will get that done.
Lou, just in terms of bottom, I got to let you go in a second here. Just in terms of bottom line, given the debt, $20 trillion in debt at least now, maybe 21 since I blinked.
$20 trillion.
Yeah, so is it possible? Is it possible to build the economy to such an extent that we can pull that back?
Absolutely. You know, and the fact that you would answer that question, because it's a question in the minds of a lot of people, that Americans question whether we can do anything. That's the result of 7.5 years of Barack Obama, who's told us what we can't be, who we're not, the kind of country he wants, which has nothing to do with the country we are. American exceptionalism is the guiding light for the entire world, whether we're talking about politics or economics or we're talking about military security. And we've just got to understand, we can do anything. And Trump understands that, and he's going to make it possible for millions of Americans to improve their lives in short order.
Well, let me just say that, honestly, you have my personal endorsement if you're listening. If you've never really watched Lou Dobbs' show on Fox Business, you need to, because Lou talks about everything, and he's always right from my perspective, honestly. And it's on from 7 to 9 this week. Monday through Thursday.
This week, the convention here in Cleveland, and then 7 to 8.
Oh, 7
Monday through Friday, we're up to
the abbreviated version of Lou Dobbs. Lou, thank you so much. It's so nice to meet you. All right, Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
The next generation, this is for you. Your war is here. You don't have to go searching for it. Your people are afraid. I stand among you, walking. I was allowed to walk with giants, all right? And now we're looking for the next generation of giants. Who among you will love something more than you love yourself, all right? Who among you are going to step up and take the fight to the enemy? Because it's here.
Sandy Rios back with you again live at the Republican Convention. And that was Marcus Luttrell last night, The Lone Survivor. That was his book, and the movie was made about his life. He was a former Navy SEAL, just in case, and the outside chances some of you didn't know. But I'm telling you, when he put aside a teleprompter last night and said, I just want to talk to you, and that's what came out. He said, you have your battle. The war is here. And I fought with what? Warriors, with giants, and we need giants in this generation. David and Jason Benham are with me, and of course you know them because they are of the... Well, almost of HGTV fame. HGTV fame in a different way. They had a show all set to go, and they were canceled because of their support for traditional marriage. And I know you know the story. That's just another victim of this politically correct, out-of-control leftist society we're trying to counter right now. But David and Jason have just written a book called Living Among Lions, How to Thrive Like Daniel in Today's Babylon. So, by way of launching that, were you guys watching last night when Lucas said that?
Yeah, I didn't get to actually see that clip, but we watched what was happening at the convention, and Brent Bozell and others that were in our hotel with us, they said it was electric. And just hearing that clip, you know, Marcus is exactly right. The battle is here, and it's time for courageous men and women to rise up. We are sick and tired of being so politically correct and so open-minded that our brains have fallen out and now our defenses are down. But the problem today is not the presence of darkness. The problem is the absence of light. Darkness only prevails when light is turned off. And that's why Jason and I, we wrote a book, Living Among Lions. We talk about Daniel and how he was a light in his Babylon. And today, we're watching America. We're seeking for political solutions to spiritual problems. Now, I get it. Politics has its place, and that's why we're here at the Republican National Convention. But we need a spiritual awakening in this nation.
You know, Jason and David, you guys are great-looking guys. You're fit, handsome. But I happen to know.
Well, David is, not Jason.
I happen to know that, because we all know it's not about the body and the looks, I happen to know that you guys have a dad who is as strong as a wrought iron rod. I mean, I've known your dad, Flip, for a number of years, had been an admirer of him. You just almost probably didn't have a choice but to be men. Am I right about that?
Well, you know, we grew up recognizing that the things that we caught were far more impacting than the things that we were taught. See, our dad, every single morning we woke up, he was either reading his Bible or he was on his knees praying in front of our couch. And then we got to see him in front of abortion clinics. We got to see him speaking in front of large crowds, saying things that were right, that lined up with biblical truth. And people were yelling at him. We saw him get spit on. We saw him get punched in the face, stand up. And my dad, when he fell back, he had broken his finger. And the police officer ran up to him and said, "Sir, do you want to press charges against this man that just hit you in the face?" And he said, "If he's willing to apologize to me and listen to me just for 60 seconds, I won't press charges." And the man came up to my dad, and my dad said, "I forgive you." And the man, he was a grown man, huge guy, started bawling his eyes out. My brother and I witnessed that. And so when the fires of culture came on us, we knew that the courage that our dad had, he passed it down to us. And we give God all the credit for that. And you know what we need in America today is a father's heart revival. We have fatherlessness that's ransacking our streets. Our dad was a father. We want to be fathers, and we're calling out other men to be fathers as well.
And I happen to know, because I kind of witnessed it. I can't even remember the circumstance, but your dad still holds your feet to the fire, doesn't he? I mean, your dad is not saying, "Good job, you're wonderful," right?
Oh, no.
Your dad doesn't do that, does he?
Here's what's interesting, and this is David speaking, by the way, the smarter of the two. When we got fired by HGTV, it was so funny, because we literally got fired on Facebook. Then we start receiving calls from Greta, Hannity, O'Reilly. All of them were calling us. You name the network, they were calling us. But the first phone call that we got from a friend was actually our dad. And our dad told us, he said, "Boys, the Lord is about to cash in his chips on you. You better stand strong." And he goes, and I just got a call. He said this. He goes, "I just got a call from CNN. They want an exclusive. And I'm taking it." And I said, "Dad, listen, give us one day. Just give us one day to stand strong." And he goes, "Okay, I'll give you one day. If you don't stand strong, I'm going to do it."
See, all right, so you don't have a choice. You've got accountability till God takes him home. And that's what the example is for you. And it's big shoes to fill. But that explains a lot of your greatness. Okay, so let's talk about, what we just heard from Lucas Cottrell. He's not talking about in spiritual terms. I don't even know where he is spiritually, although he did say that he's on his knees praying every day. So,
yeah, and he also said those four very powerful words: "America is the light." That's what he said, and that is so true. You know, America was the light. We look at our pilgrim forefathers that came over in the 1600s, and all of that history of how they came over, and they got on their knees, and they cried out to the Lord, and 107-odd years later, the founding fathers crying out to God in the Constitutional Convention. And yet that history is being rewritten right before our eyes. And when a prevailing worldview is going to be overtaken by a new worldview, two things have to happen. Words have to be redefined, and history has to be rewritten. And those in office today are all about that, rewriting the history. And David and I are here to remind people of our true heritage in America, as Marcus Luttrell did. America is the light. We're not perfect. Look, I don't judge my brother on the things that he did when he was 18. He's 40 now.
Thank goodness, right?
He's 40 now. He doesn't act like he did when he's 18, and I got plenty of dirt on him, trust me. In the same way, America, yeah, we did some stupid stuff 150 years ago. But by God's grace, we had a system that was created that we could actually, women can have rights, all people can vote, all of these things that maybe didn't happen 200 years ago, but they do now. And so that's why we believe America is the light, and it will only continue to be the light as we get back under God.
Hey, David, I happen to have been in earshot of more than one young pastor ruining the fact, in fact, I think the emerging church is big on this, that Christians, and it's not just your generation, I know this, but I'm going to pick
sure.
on them for a minute.
Yes.
Christians are too involved in the political process. They're too enamored of America, and we have to separate our faith, our evangelical, our witness for Christ from our love of our country. From your perspective at this point in your life, how would you respond to that?
Okay, so first and foremost, what we have is we have kind of a milquetoast generation that's coming up where they're an inch deep and about a mile wide. It doesn't mean that they're not zealous. It doesn't mean they don't have the right heart. But unfortunately, we fail in the younger generation to understand first and foremost that our faith transcends partisan politics. So they're right in a sense that our faith transcends it all. In other words, it's not us lining up with the Republican platform. It's the Republican or Democratic platforms lining up with what God says is true. So we are one nation under God, not over God, not beside God, but under God. Now we're one nation without God. But secondly, they have to understand is that our faith must become a framework through which we live faithful in all areas of life. People ask me and Jason, are you pastors? We say, no, we're entrepreneurs. Well, then why are you guys so vocal about your faith? Well, because it's our faith. It is life in Jesus Christ. And so the standards of God in every area of life, his boundaries bring his blessings. And when his boundaries are moved, the blessings are replaced with burdens. That applies in marriage. That applies in your finances. It applies in government. It applies in media. It applies across every sphere of culture.
This is Jason. I'm going to interrupt him and just wrap a bow on this. We're called as Christians to be salt and light. Salt has to get out of the salt shaker, and it has to be scattered everywhere. We can't say, I can't get involved in politics because God, you know, Jesus was never involved in politics. That's not true. Jesus called us to do greater things than even he did. And so we are here to influence our culture. And one of the best ways that we can do that is to influence our governing leaders. That's what salt does. Right? We don't want to keep it in the salt shaker. The devil loves the reasoning of, hey, Christians shouldn't be involved in politics. I think the devil sits back and laughs hysterically and says, good, leave that to me.
And another thing that we see is that these new leaders, they want to, do you take salt and pile it up on your steak or you pile it up on your food? No, you sprinkle it out and spread it. Today, we're piling up into these big churches and staying in these little cocoons where we're not persecuted, we're not ridiculed, we're not called names, we're not, you know, false narratives are coming against us. We're called to scatter and get everywhere.
You know, I was just remembering in the German church, pre-World War II, Hitler told the church, the pastors of the state church was the Lutheran church, just leave, you know, you take care of church. And just leave the state to me. Just you,
that's right.
We'll leave you guys alone. You go over there and you do church stuff, and just leave the state to me. And they gladly did that. Of course, then Hitler did not leave them alone. He replaced the cross with a swastika, and it got.
And they signed. They actually signed a Reichskonkordat document, which it literally was a deal with the church under the leadership of the Vatican. 20,000 spiritual leaders signed it, and it said you can gather. You can pray, you can evangelize, you can sing, and you can even be paid by the state, but you cannot organize and speak against the state.
Yes.
That's what they said, and that's exactly what we're finding today, and that's why we wrote the book, Living Among Lions, because we see young Daniel between the ages of 13 to 15 being taken into Babylon. He's taken out of the comfort of his little God-fearing environment because his nation had turned their backs on God, and yet Daniel stood faithfully across three kings and two empires.
When my husband and I are pretty harsh about this. I have a son that's 36. So
wow.
When we look at the younger generation, the characterization of today's man is like carrying a briefcase, listening to his iPod, little shoulders and little, you know, like couldn't defend if he had to. What's that all about, and is there a cure for that?
Well, if I could say something to that, this is Jason. The devil has to rob men of their masculinity. Look, you have a 36-year-old son. Participation trophies came out, you know, probably when your son was playing in Little League. Maybe not quite as much, but definitely, I mean, now everybody gets a trophy.
No, good job.
Our
good
young
job.
Kids.
Everybody does a good job.
They grow up not knowing how to deal with failure.
Mm-mm.
You know, and that's a manly characteristic, is how to get punched in the face and then get back up. How to get knocked down and get back up. How to deal with failure properly. How to go up. You know what? You ask a girl out, she says no, get over it. Continue to move on. But now our young men, they don't do that because they can live vicariously through their little iPhones, and they can be addicted to games as long as possible. And we just have this teeny bopper culture, and we have men who are growing up and becoming pajama boy, and they're not wanting to go out there and fight the battles that need to be fought. Not just in terms of going overseas, but in terms of fighting spiritual battles here today. We have pajama boy Christian men who are all about love, 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 but they don't realize that love is a man.
Yes,
his name is Jesus.
And what's the cure for that? Is it too late? For men that
no.
actually say, you know, I guess I kind of do play video games still, and I'm 35, and I've never gotten, and I don't know how to, you know.
It's never too late. It is never too late as long as they are breathing. We write a chapter in our book about identity. It's all about identity. And when they recognize who they are, that the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords lives inside of them. Or if they recognize the fact that, you know what, I was created for a purpose by the God that hung the stars in the sky and sets the moon and the planets into orbit and all of these things. When they realize their identity as God's creation, and then when a Christian realizes their identity as a child of God, an inheritance of the eternal glory that Jesus has earned for us, then our life takes on a whole new meaning. And I'll tell you this, young Daniel went into Babylon, he knew exactly who he was. And so when the winds of culture no longer favored his convictions, he stood with courage. That's the key. It starts with conviction, it moves from there to commitment, and then it stands with courage.
And let me say this. This is why it's so important about identity, is that you go into the African, you know, the plains and the deserts and all that, you don't see a lion trying to act like a hyena, because that runs contrary to its nature. A lion knows what it is, and it acts according to its nature. We believe that Christians, especially Christian men in this nation right now, need to recognize who they are. They are sons of the King. The Lion of the tribe of Judah lives in them and is all-powerful to bring peace through everything that they do. But they're going to have to go out there, and it's going to involve a fight. And they've got to be willing to do that. And when they know who they are, we don't have to try to tell them what to do. It's just going to come from the inside out.
All right, well, the book is called Living Among Lions, How to Thrive Like Daniel in Today's Babylon. You know, I always think of in him we live and move and have our being. How can we separate any part of our life from our service to him? We can't.
No, you can't. It's like waking up in the morning saying, hey, you know what? I'm going to try to blink 500 times today. I mean, you don't even think about blinking, right? Because it's second nature. It's just what happens. The same should be true in what we do with our faith. Everywhere we go, we represent Jesus Christ, and we need to live and breathe Jesus Christ everywhere we go. It doesn't matter. This is why we're at the Republican National Convention, and yes, there will be some spiritual leaders that say the Benham brothers are political. It's not true. We're just being salty. And you know what? Anytime there's a party, God's people need to show up.
I'm for that. All right, you guys, Jason and David Benham. And the book, again, is called Living Among Lions, How to Thrive Like Daniel in Today's Babylon. What a privilege to meet you guys. And please tell your father, that lion, that I said hello.
Okay? We definitely will.
Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.